The Hookup with Hannah Riley.
Dear Team Hookup, so I've got a weird one. I was recently seeing this guy who told me he had his dick pierced.
If I'm in a casual relationship and going on dates, when should I stop sleeping with my casual partner?
So I've been with my boyfriend for about a year. About 6 months ago, I told him that I loved him and he didn't say it back.
The Hookup with Hannah Riley, the show about love and f***ing on Triple J.
We're going to be covering heaps tonight on the Hookup Q&A, including the big L. Oh, what happens if you drop the love bomb and all you hear is silence? We've all been there, I think. Or, you know, what could possibly go wrong if you decide to pierce your pink bits? And how does the pill affect your hormones? Will it make you gain weight?
The Hookup with Hannah Riley. Love and f***ing on Triple J.
Warning, sex and adult themes. We're kicking off our sex and relationships Q&A where you can ask us anything. And joining me are our experts, Dr. Deborah Bateson. She's the Medical Director of Family Planning New South Wales. And Patrick Lombroso, who is a psychologist and sex therapist. Thank you both so much for coming back to The Hookup.
Good evening.
Having us.
Pleasure.
Now, to get things started, you know, we're not going to be dancing around. We're getting straight into the nitty-gritty. And we're going to be talking about pleasure, pain, and piercings. Now, we heard from Lisa. Here's what she had to say.
Dear Team Hookup, so I've got a weird one. I was recently seeing this guy who told me he had his dick pierced. We didn't end up getting down and dirty. He turned out to be a Donald Trump-level racist. But it got me thinking about genital piercings. I read that they're supposed to enhance sexual sensation for the person and for their partner, but I also think surely there should be some risk involved in stabbing your penis or clitoris with a needle, then shoving a metal bar in there forever. True or false? Lisa Adelaide.
The show about love and f***ing on Triple J.
All right. Dick and clit piercings, are they a good idea? Can they enhance pleasure? Are they painful for the other person? And what other risks? We'll start with you, Deb.
Well, look, I've certainly, in my career, in my clinic, I've seen a few, both penis and you know, female piercings. So I think the first thing is to know actually what they are. So the commonest male piercing is sometimes it's called a Prince Albert, actually. It's a ring that goes through from the back of the shaft of the penis and then the other side of the ring comes out through the urethra, the sort of end of the penis.
Is that named because he had one, or is it?
I think that's the case. Right, yeah. Right. So quite interesting. It stayed on all this time. And the interesting thing is with clitoral piercings, in fact, generally they're not. Okay. So the clitoris has got about, you know, 80,000 nerve endings. Generally, the piercings are of the clitoral hood. So that's the bit of skin that goes over the clitoris, and that's where the piercing occurs. So I think when we're thinking about, you know, what are the risks associated with this, I think, you know, first of all, I think, well, one of them, of course, could be regret. So I think it's very important to think about, is this something that you really, you know, you really want to do? So I think it's, you know, it's very, very important to think this through. But of course, you know, I think the other key things are, of course, that you're piercing something that's actually, you know, near very sensitive parts. You need to make sure that you actually go to someone who's an expert, that knows what they're doing, that knows the anatomy.
Right. This is not a job for your housemate.
This is not, yeah, absolutely, because there is a risk of damage. The, you know, that very sensitive tissue that you don't want to damage.
With all piercings, it comes with an, you know, potential risk, but especially with all those nerves centered in that area, I suppose.
Absolutely. So there is risk of nerve damage. There is potentially risk of scar tissue in places you don't want it. But then, of course, there is that infection risk as well. So again, needing to make sure that you go to an accredited, you know, reputable provider, someone that knows what they're doing. They've got sterile instruments, because there are risks in any piercings, whenever you're piercing the skin, of HIV or hepatitis. Mm. So incredibly important.
Patrick, as a sex therapist, what's your view about whether they enhance pleasure or not?
I really don't have much opinion on this other than don't do it.
Really? That sounds like an opinion.
I have to be honest on this. I spend a big chunk of my week working with men who suffer from erectile dysfunction. A lot of it is due to surgical problems, and it's just one of those areas. I personally, and maybe it's because I'm an old guy, I don't see the point or I really see a great point not to do it. If you think about it, there's a zillion nerves there that can really cause you harm. Your penis isn't really designed to have anything done with it other than, you know, all the nice things you do on your own or with a partner. You don't want to do damage to the structure. Even where, like, I'll give you an example. I see guys who have a condition called Peyronie's disease, which is a scar tissue problem, and that's where you get a bending of the penis. Now, to try and correct something like that, really, there aren't that many options other than to go surgical. And even then, we really want to not go surgical anywhere near the penis if we can avoid it. So in terms of getting an accredited dick piercer, I don't know. Where do you get that accreditation from?
Look, I'm sure they're out there. Speaking of pain and pleasure, Amanda from Brisbane wrote to us. Here's what she wants to know. My boyfriend hits himself in the head as he comes because he says it feels good. But then it always hurts him afterwards. And meanwhile, I'm just there being awkward. Is there any science from this pain and pleasure combo? Patrick, can I start with you?
Remarkably, there's not a huge amount which explains why we experience pleasure or pain. And there are obviously things which bring people a certain amount of pleasure. For example, bungee jumping. I couldn't think of anything more horrific. Actually, penile piercing is now top of the list. But you know, there are people who like doing these sorts of sports and recreations, and for them it brings great pleasure. For others, it would bring absolute terror and pain. With regards to this particular situation, is it unusual? Yeah, it's unusual. Is it not normal? I wouldn't say no. It's not a situation. The thing that I would be concerned with is that he doesn't actually do himself harm. So he doesn't fracture an eye socket or break a tooth or something like that. But in terms of, you know, hitting in the face and stuff like that, that is actually quite common.
Yeah, kind of punishment with orgasm complex.
So sadomasochism, perhaps.
Yeah, right. Any thoughts on this?
Oh, really? I mean, it's just, you know, again, if there's two people involved, making sure that, you know, both are agreeing and consenting and into it. I mean, I think that's just the only thing for me to add.
I mean, Amanda says she doesn't really know what to do. Like, any suggestions for what Amanda can be doing while her boyfriend is hitting himself in the head?
Make a cup of tea.
I was going to say, a nice cup of tea. Sounds very
cup
good.
Of tea.
Or maybe, like, monitor him. Maybe make, like, a safe word or something, or, you know, have
but
a
he's
panic
hitting himself,
talk
though.
To him as well. Yeah.
But you know, like you said, you want to make sure no one's doing any damage to the brain.
Well, I think the key thing is communicate. I mean, you know, to talk to him and find out and talk together really about, you know, what it is, and maybe there's something they can do together rather than
there's,
you know,
probably
having a cup
safer
of tea.
Places he could cop a slap, which would give him more pain but less risk. I'm thinking probably, look, there are all sorts of toys and things like that, which especially there's like a paddle that's shaped like a boot. So if you ever had that slapped across your butt, that would absolutely kill. But the butt takes stuff a lot better on the outside than obviously your brain and your head. So
exactly. Hey, what happens when you work up the courage to stare the person that you love in the eyes and tell them, say, I love you, and then silence? And should you say it back if you don't mean it? Charlotte from Sydney got in touch with us.
So I've been with my boyfriend for about a year, and everything's going amazing. Like, we have heaps in common. We're always laughing. We have a really good sex life. However, about 6 months ago, I told him that I loved him, and he didn't say it back. I guess after that, nothing ever really changed in our relationship, which is really good because I thought I scared him away. But he hasn't said it since. And I don't think he ever will, because he kind of explained to me that he doesn't see the significance of it. It seems to pour out when I'm like quite drunk, which is, you know, classic white girl. But we had another talk about it, and he was just like, you know, I care about you more than anyone, but he's just like, I'd only say it to make you happy. And I'm like, yeah, but not the point. Saying I love you is really important to me. I say it to all my family members, and to a few of my friends, and I just can't grasp the idea that he might never ever say it to me, because I can definitely see a future for us. So I just wondering if I'm really overacting something that seems so trivial, or should I wait it out?
The Hookup with Hannah Riley.
Oh, Charlotte. You're listening to The Hookup with Hannah Riley on Triple J. I'm joined by Dr. Deborah Basin. She's the Medical Director of Family Planning New South Wales. Not sure if this is exactly your area, Deb, but I'm also joined by Patrick Lombroso, who's a psychologist and sex therapist. It's definitely in your area. Could you help Charlotte at all in this situation?
First thing I'd say to Charlotte is Charlotte never is a very, very, very long time. And if this gentleman just doesn't be at that if he just isn't at that moment at this present point, it doesn't mean he's never going to be at that moment. So a person who I'm probably giving a lot away today, but a person who I've been with for 24 years, I dropped the L-bomb on her and caught her by surprise. And it took her, I don't know, several months before she returned serve. Right. So I wouldn't despair too much.
Yeah, it is a really tough situation. I know that I've gotten into some really, really bad trouble with this. I had a situation where I thought I heard him say it. When we were like making out, I heard him say it. And I was like, did you just say what I think you said? And he was like, what do you think I said? I was like, I thought I heard you say that you love me. And he was like, I guess I do. And I was like, oh, great. And then the next day I was like, what have I done? I've kind of semi-bullied this guy into saying that he loves me. And it turned into this huge, very complicated, messy thing. So Charlotte, if you can learn anything from that is, I guess, don't push it, I suppose. But in the same At the same time, I heard her say that he was saying he just doesn't see why it's relevant. And I have trouble understanding that. I have trouble understanding the idea that you wouldn't, if you did really care about someone, that you say that you love them. I mean, and he might not be at that stage yet. He might not be ready to say that. But I don't really understand the theory that if you do love someone, you shouldn't say it.
Yes, he's overly honest, really, isn't he? And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm by no means an expert in this area, but it's it can just take time and just asking each other, what does it mean to you? What does it mean? And clearly, in Charlotte's family, as she says, she uses it with her family, with her friends. It perhaps means something a little bit different. So it's exploring that. I'm sure Patrick, you've got much more experience.
I think I'd agree with that. I think the situation is he might have a big tick box list, and he's thinking that he wants to maintain a certain degree of integrity with her. And perhaps she's not ticking all of the boxes yet. It's not to say she never will, or maybe she's ticked some and he hasn't noticed.
Actually, on the flip side of this, we've got a question from Sam, and it says, he said he loved me. I said it back, but didn't mean it. I just didn't want to hurt his feelings. Am I the worst person ever? Should I tell him the truth? Oh, what should Sam do?
Look, shit happens. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, that's fine.
And here's the thing. It shows that you're a good-hearted person. And sometimes you're in a situation where you want to express kindness, when you want to express lovingness towards somebody, but you might not be in love with them. And once again, you may not be in love with them yet. So it doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you an empathetic person.
It is. It's being polite and kind. And you're right.
I don't know. I think it is at the same time you are trying to protect that person's feelings. But in doing that, that could lead to so much more pain. And Sam asks, should I tell him the truth?
But then it's recognizing it. So that's the next bit of it. So it's being, kind, but then it's recognizing it, and then I think you have to do something about it.
Really?
Well, what's been the consequence of this particular declaration? You yourself, Hannah, said that just because the love part of things, I love you more, or I love you too, doesn't necessarily change things. I'm wondering if she just leaves it as it is, whether or not it may not change anything, or it may resolve itself.
Well, I think I know if I was in Sam's situation, it would be more my own personal guilt, feeling like I'm sort of living a lie, or that I've said this and I'm being ingenuine in some way. And I guess in that case, I guess they just have to grapple with whether they're okay with living with that guilt, or whether it's better to potentially be honest and hurt the person's feelings by explaining that, or whether that would do any good. I don't know. It's really hard. Yasmin, thanks for calling us. You dropped the love bomb with your boyfriend, but where did you do it?
I was in a really busy restaurant and we'd gone out for our 4 months, and I told him I loved him over dinner and he fainted.
Oh my God.
And all the waitresses and everything came running at the bar.
So was it a good faint or a bad faint?
It was shock, I think.
So what happened when he came to?
He just apologised, but he didn't say that.
Oh, and what happened?
For a while.
For a while, but he eventually did.
Yeah.
Oh, Yasmin, well, look, you're obviously a powerful presence, and he was just a little overwhelmed with the power of your love. We're talking about sex now. Can be pretty emotional, and sometimes our bodies don't react in the way we expect or want them to.
Hey, so here's the thing that happens to me. My name's Grace, and I cry during sex. I don't know how common this is, but it happens. I'm not sad when I do it, and I'm not ashamed either. It normally happens after a powerful orgasm. Any reason why this might be happening?
It's The Hookup on Triple J.
You're on The Hookup Q&A, and I am joined by Dr. Deborah Bateson and Patrick Lombroso, who's a psychologist and sex therapist. Patrick, why might Grace be crying after sex? Is this common?
Crying after sex is actually quite common, especially after orgasm. It could be for a number of different reasons. I wouldn't necessarily be overly concerned about it, unless, of course, the reason you're crying is that sex was so bad or that it was painful or for some other traumatic reason. If there is some sort of trauma in your past, you might want to look at something like that. Mm. But the thing is, it's multifaceted. Whatever happens within the bedrooms, there's all sorts of contextual elements that can affect it. History, current circumstances, diet, hormone, anything. So I think the thing there is, number one, don't be overly concerned. It's a lot more common than most people think. And number two, if you are concerned, I think you really do need to maybe go and see someone professionally if it's causing you distress. If it's not causing you distress, hey, enjoy the tears.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Deb, any insight on one?
I think that key is where you say that, Patrick, is about the distress. I think with a lot of things around, so that people I see, often I'll see couples where, in fact, you know, I think oh, you know, that sounds interesting, what you're up to, but both are happy, no one's distressed, everyone's fine. And it's whether it's causing that personal distress or distress to a partner, and that's when you do need to seek help. But I think in this situation, no, I think that's perfect advice.
We actually just had a text on crying after sex that reads, I've been with a couple of girls who have done that. Makes you wonder if you've done something wrong. I've been reassured that they're tears of joy. So whoever you are, you're doing a great job. Congratulations.
The Hookup on Triple J.
Stu got in touch with us about what his body does after orgasm.
Love and f***ing.
Wow.
The Hookup on Triple J.
Hi all. I have epileptic-like shudders and convulsions after I come. The more intense the orgasm, the longer and more intense the convulsion. This involves my left arm and shoulder twitching. Sometimes it's my neck. I get out of control eye movements and my head turns. This can last for several minutes. In the worst case, I nearly punched a partner when they may become so strongly during oral sex. I'd like to know what causes this. Is it normal to be all twitchy after an orgasm? Thanks, Stu from Queensland.
Patrick, what do you think?
It's a big question. I think it is normal to be twitchy after an orgasm. The question is, though, is this beyond what would be considered within the realm or the spectrum of normal response? To me, it doesn't sound as though it is. I would probably be seeking some sort of specialist advice, possibly with a neurologist or something like that. That there could be so many factors that are affecting this, which is perhaps being triggered at a point of orgasm. So I would probably seek the advice of a specialist on this one.
Now, speaking of unexpected things that happen after sex, Bailey from Melbourne has written into the show and asks, is it normal to experience really bad abdominal pain after sex? It's a sharp stabbing pain in my lower abdomen. I'm on the IUD, which is the intrauterine device, and haven't had a period in 8 months now. Should I be worried? I haven't seen my GP and I have seen my GP and gyno, and they said it's nothing to be worried about, but it's really bad pain. Help. I'm joined by Dr. Deb Bateson from Family Planning New South Wales. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think, Bailey, I don't no woman should experience really bad pain after sex, that is, or during sex. That's not something that anyone should put up with. So I think we do need to get to the bottom of what's going on. Just to say, with an IUD, that's an intrauterine device. There's a hormonal type of IUD where women often don't have any periods because the lining of the uterus is thinned out. So that's not a worry in itself. But I think here, describing that sharp stabbing pain, there can be lots of different reasons for it. I mean, sometimes it is simply something like, you know, the position of that you're having sex in. So it might be worth just trying, you know, a few different positions. But there can be other things that can cause that pain. Probably not to do with the IUD, but you can't exclude that. But things like endometriosis, and there's something called vaginismus. It all sounds a bit technical, but that's where the muscles clamp down sometimes. They contract a bit like a spasm, I suppose.
We've done a couple of eps on vaginismus. You can actually head to the podcast and check out the episode on that.
That's right. And it can set up a bit of a cycle. And so, you know, I think it's certainly worth, Bailey, just, you know, going and see somebody. I don't know whether you've got a family planning clinic near where you live.
Good plug.
But it sounds like it's something that needs a bit of attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Izzy from Coburg has gotten in touch with us about the pill. She says, I have a question about whether oral contraception increases weight gain. I know that it messes with your hormones and stuff, but I don't know whether it makes weight gain easier or whether it just makes it harder to lose weight. Dr. Dem?
Excellent. It's a great question. Thanks, Izzy. So look, what we know when we look at the research of a whole population of women taking the pill, in fact, there's no overall increase in weight gain for that population. But we know within that some women will gain weight, most will stay the same, and some will actually lose weight. So what's it all to do with? Well, we do know that some of the pills, you can sometimes cause some fluid retention. So, you know, you can have that sort of bloated feeling, and that fluid can cause a little bit of weight gain. And then another component can be an increase in appetite. So we know that the pill is made up of two hormones. There's an estrogen hormone and a progesterone hormone, and that progesterone can stimulate the appetite sometimes for some women. So it's useful knowing about that. But what we can do then is, if a woman's choosing to use the pill, there's lots of different contraceptives, of course, but we can sometimes manipulate, change the dose, change the hormones to, you know, to make it suit that particular woman. So you're not imagining it. For some women there is an increase, but for most women there isn't.
Yeah, with the pill, it seems like the process, is it usually just, you just have to try and see?
So with the pill, there's different, you know, different hormones, and they've got different characteristics. So what we would do is, as doctors, is try to match, you know, that woman's need. So, you know, maybe some side effects she's had in the past, or maybe she wants some benefits, such as benefit for her skin, or benefits for her periods, for instance, and match the type of pill to her. But sometimes you're absolutely right. I mean, I wish I could say, look, there's a lot of research, a lot of evidence to show this pill's better than that pill. But often in the end, that is actually not there. So it is sometimes a matter of trial and error. But we, you know, certainly come along and talk to your doctor and say what it is that's bothering you and what it is that you want out of your pill. But also just remember, we're actually tending to move. The pill is still very useful, but we're moving away to something called LARC methods of contraception now. So I don't know whether you've heard of the word LARC. It stands for long-acting reversible contraceptives. So that's like the IUD we were just talking about, and implants.
Implants like Implanon that get inserted.
That's right.
It's a small metal rod that gets inserted into your arm.
Yeah, it's a plastic rod. Plastic. It's a flexible plastic rod, and it contains progesterone. talking about piercings before. It just sits under the skin of your upper inner arm, and in fact, women, you know, love them. So it's great. It lasts for up to 3 years. If you hate it, you can take it out. It's immediately gone, immediately reversible. But it provides really effective. I mean, very effective and cost-effective contraception for those 3 years. So sometimes it's just making people aware of these different options.
In terms of other oral medications like antidepressants, you've written in and want to know if there's any way of taking them and increasing your sex drive. James got in touch with hookup@abc.net.au and asks, my girl and I have been together for 4 years, we're almost 20, and don't have sex. It's not that we don't want to, believe me, when we're keen and horny at the beginning, but after about 6 months, we stopped doing things. And now I'm never aroused. Any ideas? I'm on antidepressants and can hear that this can drive your libido down. But is there any way to get it back again while staying on the meds? Patrick, any ideas?
Yeah, great question. There does seem to be quite a bit of evidence linking antidepressants with loss of libido. In fact, some of the medications that are on the market right now are either failed antidepressants or they're antidepressants that are being used for sexual dysfunction purposes. Think about sexual desire this way, though. And I think sexual desire is one of those areas that we don't seem to understand. There's a huge amount of research done, but we still seem to be missing the point. So what I want you to do is think about it this way. Imagine sexual desire is a Ferrari. Okay, for that Ferrari to work, it needs petrol and it needs a driver. So if there's no fuel in that Ferrari, it doesn't cease being a Ferrari. It still has, you know, magnificent engineering. It has the potential to go really fast, but you still need fuel. So the issue here is if you haven't had sex in 6 months, what sort of erotic stimulation are you getting to start off with? So have you forgotten what it's like just to physically hold a person, to feel their breath against your neck, to be able to caress, touch, simple things that bring you closer, that give you pleasure? That's where I would be starting right now. And then and start with just simple things where you're just holding each other, or try a 3-minute kiss. Something which just reconnects you with that individual, where you have that moment, there's almost like a gasping moment where you go, damn, I forgot how good that is. And that's where I would start. You don't have to go straight into coitus or, you know, all sorts of weird, wonderful positions. Just start off with a kiss. And perhaps work your way towards naked hugging, and then perhaps progress towards genital contact later on.
The Hookup with Hannah Riley. Love and f***ing on Triple J.
Last week we were talking about the impact money can have on our relationships, and this got Brandon from Ginderbine thinking. Hi guys, I've been interested in this girl and have been seeing her for a while, but notices she drives a banged up old car. It's quite ugly and ancient. Coming from a wealthy socioeconomic background, I'm put off by this. I don't know how to feel or if I should continue to see her. Does this make me a bad person if I'm second-guessing us because of this? Whew. So when I read this, I had two thoughts. The first was, Brandon, you've obviously got a good heart because you're writing in to ask this question and you're second-guessing it, because there would be people out there who would think that and never second guess it. That would just be inherent in their nature and they wouldn't guess themselves. My second thought is, you are being such an idiot. It's a car.
I take it that you have an opinion on this, Hannah.
I do. I do. I have a small one. Well, I mean, don't you?
Look, when I first read this, I had a similar sort of reaction to your own. And then I started thinking about it and I started to think that this fellow Brandon, although he seems like a bit of a DH when he writes this, I think there could be a genuine inquiry there. But I think it really goes down to his own psychology. And I think he's fearful of a whole bunch of things that can't really reveal themselves in this letter or this inquiry. Mm. So once again, I'm not trying to drum up business here, but I think there are psychological issues here. If he really does feel this way because of socioeconomic peer group pressure, then I think you owe it to this girl to really break up with her, because I think if really that's so important to you, she would be much better off not dealing with someone perhaps as superficial.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know, that question just boggled me, but Brandon, I hope you take stock, not literal stock of like what you have in a cupboard, but of, you know, what matters to you emotionally, whether that is the kind of car that someone drives or not.
The Hookup on Triple J.
To the Hookup. If I'm in a casual relationship and meeting girls and going on dates, when should I stop sleeping with my casual partner? I don't want to be an asshole.
What do you think, guys? So you're dating someone with a kind of, you know, sorry, sleeping with someone in a sort of friends with benefits capacity, but also dating people with the prospect of a relationship. On what number date should you stop sleeping with that friends with benefit relationship?
It's all about communication, isn't it? But it's also thinking about, you know, are you putting it other people at risk as well? So I think that's a really important thing to think about, what it is, you know, what it is that you're doing. So I think, you know, it is just about working out your priorities, but just making sure, as I say, that you're using condoms when you should be, and that you're just, you know, making sure you're protecting those other people as well as yourself.
I think from a psychosexual perspective, we look at a lot of new types of relationships, open relationships, polyamory, all these sorts of things. The relationships that seem to go very well are those where they've got structured rules, believe it or not. So there might be a rule which says that if you're going to have sex with somebody else, then these are the rules for having sex, that you're transparent, that you're willing to share information and so on and so forth. I think you really need to look at structures. So it may not be at what stage do I stop sleeping with my friend, but really at what stage do you set parameters, guidelines for the relationship? And I think if you follow those guidelines and if one of those important guidelines is that of transparency, then it shouldn't really matter so long as you're sticking with whatever you've agreed to.
Yeah, so I suppose maybe the answer there would be this: you ask the person that you're dating when the point is that you stop sleeping with that other person.
I think that's fair.
We've got one last bonus question, and Deb, I think this one's for you. Does the pull-out method work for Maddie in Brizzy?
Well, so it's called, you know, withdrawal or coitus interruptus, and it's free, you know, it's always there. Is it effective? No.
But it could end up being very expensive if you need either an abortion or a baby on the way.
Absolutely, and we know that the data, it's hard to collect it sometimes, but we think up to as many as 22%, so that's almost, well, more than one in five women using this method of contraception will become pregnant in a year. Now, we know that people that perhaps practice it, older people perhaps who practice it, have been practicing it for a long time, they can get the rate down a bit, but, you know, no, I mean, it's, you know, obviously it's often used by young people, young men, and it obviously involves, you know, withdrawing the penis before ejaculation, and things just don't go according to plan, and there's, you know, there can also, the data's a little bit, it's interesting, but there does seem, again, that there can be, you know, sperm, in the pre-ejaculate as well. So we would not recommend it. Look, if it happens, it doesn't protect against STIs as well. If it happens, obviously you can, you know, go and be tested, and don't forget the emergency contraception, the morning after pill. But no, I mean, it's not an effective method of contraception.
I had a gorgeous hippie friend who used this method and was like, it's fun, we do it by the moon. A couple of months later, pregnant. Yes. So there you go.
The Hookup on Triple J.
Ooh, there's the brown starfish.